In this episode, we talk with the utterly wonderful Professor Amy Brown about why she doesn't like sea lions, looking at breastfeeding from a biological perspective, women's experience of feeding their babies, and how to navigate the internet as a birth worker, and more. Professor Amy Brown is a Professor of Maternal and Child Public Health at Swansea University in the UK. She is based in the Department of Public Health, Policy and Social Sciences, where she is the director of their research centre, LIFT, which stands for Lactation, Infant Feeding and Translation. She researches everything to do with becoming and being a new parent, with a particular focus on infant feeding, mental health and normal baby behaviour. The ultimate aim of Amy's research being to change society and culture, which, as she states, turns out to not be an overnight job. Amy wants to see a future where women and families are respected, valued, and supported in growing, birthing, and caring for their babies. Amy has written extensively, a plethora of books, research, blog articles, and videos, which you can find literally everywhere, because she is very much in demand, and we are super thrilled to have her here in the cauldron, but also on her website, which of course we will link to. So enjoy this episode. I'm Katie James, and this is the Midwives Cauldron Podcast. Each episode, I'm joined by my incredible co-host, Dr. Rachel Reed. Listen in as we hubble, bubble, toil and trouble our way through aspects of womanhood, midwifery, birth and lactation. So go on, subscribe now, and hear us on your favourite podcast host. But good morning.
Morning. Hello.
Morning.
Thank you so much for joining us in the cauldron. And on the podcast, we are really, really thrilled to have you, Amy, here with us today. And we're just really excited to have you here, to have really Professor Amy Brown, who is a Professor of Maternal and Child Public Health, and also the Director of LIFT, which is Lactation, Infant Feeding and Translation. And she is a researcher with a huge, massive, wonderful focus on infant feeding, mental health and normal baby behaviour. But most importantly, what I must say about Amy is she has some interesting loves. Gin, cats and running, which is just so perfect for me and Rachel, because I hit the gin button, also the cats, but Rachel hits the cats and the running, or as she likes to call it, trot stumbling. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I am pre-coffee here, so this is slightly worrying, but I'm unleashed without a proper coffee because it's early.
I should just ramble on a bit more, let you down the coffee like it's a shot. I think, Rachel, I don't know how much of a delay you're on. She is having some great internet disturbances today. We've had some brilliant poses just before as we tried to get the sound sorted. So if Rachel, if you don't see her moving or you think that she's just looking at you really sternly, it's just that her camera's frozen or she'll turn the picture off, because we interviewed someone who then said towards the end, I just thought Rachel was really angry with me and everything I said.
Okay.
So where do we start? I mean, Amy, you have written so many books. You have really made a huge impact for healthcare professionals, for mums, for families, particularly in your work with mental health, infant feeding, but also a recent book on informed choice, which was just fascinating as well. Informed is best. You've written 6 books, I believe, and you have a new book coming out.
I've actually lost track. I don't know how many books I've written anymore, which makes me sound slightly insane, sort of the mad professor. I think we're coming up to 9.
Whoa.
I think. So I've got 2 coming out very soon. So one in a couple of weeks, which is Let's Talk About Feeding Your Baby, which is trying to be a really informative book, regardless of how you feed your baby. So it's got loads of stuff on breastfeeding, but it's also got a big section on safe and responsive formula feeding. And then it's got introducing solids as well. So it's trying to bring all that information together, because I think sometimes parents end up turning to less sort of scrupulous sources for formula information. So I just wanted it to be in a, here's all the information. The vast majority of people end up doing a bit of both anyway. So have it all in one place rather than going off to a formula company website to learn about how to feed their baby. So that's one. The other one is a second edition of Breastfeeding Uncovered that is coming out. So that's coming out at the end of May. It was one of those, we were waiting for it to reprint. So it was, we saw it kind of going down and down and down and realized we had to do a print rerun. And I said, oh, well, I'll do a quick edit of it just to check that everything's all right and bring it up to kind of speed. And ended up writing a new 50,000 words. A quick edit. It's just like, right, it's kind of, I mean, the first one was published in 2016 and we always plan to do an update, but this stuff moves so quickly that you're just like, oh wow, what I wrote like in 2015 16, just there's so much more to say already. So yeah, that's coming out too. Fantastic. So I think that brings us to 9.
Right, okay, good. That's fantastic.
Terrible.
Who knows? Just do quick edits and knock out a few 100,000 words and there's another book. I mean, you must have been asked so many times as a lactation consultant, I can remember early on and still now, not so much now with, but particularly in clinical practice, people would say to me, particularly my friends who are not in the healthcare or this field, they would say to me, surely what is there to know about breastfeeding? Don't you just help a mum put the baby on the breast and that's all you do?
Yeah, I felt exactly the same way, to be honest. I did not have a clue about any of this. So I was pregnant for the first time when I was 23. So I had him when I was 24. And until that point, I didn't have a clue about feeding babies at all. So I'd done a psychology degree and we did nutrition as part of that. And I remember there being one lecture that talked about breastfeeding and breast milk at all, only in the context of premature babies. And, you know, I might have kind of hazy hungover memories of that lecture, but what I took from it was that breast milk didn't really matter at all when it came to healthy term babies. You might as well just formula feed. It was only important for premature babies, and that was just in terms of cognitive development, and that was it. So I kind of went, and I was really interested in health and nutrition, and I did a master's degree, and I did my dissertation on body image of all things. Started doing a PhD that was meant to be about feeding older children, and it makes me laugh in hindsight because I really wanted to research kind of emotional feeding in older children. So the thing, you know, like you shouldn't say, oh, you've done so well, have an ice cream. Mm-hmm. Or if
but it's really nice.
If you're good, we'll go and, you know, we'll go and go for your favourite meal. Or you've got to finish your dinner if you want ice cream afterwards.
Mm.
And thankfully, I forgot all about that because, you know, then I actually had babies and realised that was a really daft thing to try and tackle. It was myself completely now. But when I was doing that PhD all about kind of starting to read about how parents feed their older children, and then I became pregnant. And it was that experience that made me realise that the whole world of breast and formula feeding was something that I kind of didn't know anything about, but was really, really complicated. And I just, as you say, I thought it was a case of you decided to breastfeed or you decided to formula feed. They were equal choices, but also that it was a choice that you then just went and got on with it. And it wasn't until I started reading about it, and the more I read about it and became interested in it and met more and more women, they kept having the same story that they wanted to breastfeed but couldn't. Yeah. And you just think, started thinking, you know, what on earth is going on here? You know, is there something about Wales that, you know, the breasts aren't working or something?
Mm-hmm.
And you go, as an academic then, you go off to the literature, and there was all this stuff around health practices, and there were bits and pieces around social influences in psychology, but not huge amounts of it. So I just became more and more fascinated by that, about how our culture, society was just really setting women up to fail or feel like failures.
Yeah.
When it wasn't their fault at all and they weren't the ones failing.
Absolutely. Oh my goodness. Yes. Yes. And that big thing of, for me, we put the guilt onto the woman herself in a way, and then we as women take that on board. But it's this, it's so much bigger than this. You know, we talk about the postnatal service as the Cinderella service. It's really overlooked. But then you look at breastfeeding and, you know, trying to get research grants for something that's like, well, it's not really acute care. And most people not in this world are a bit like, well, does it really matter that much? So, you know, even starting at the ground level to try and get research done, and then to have research that's looking at women's feelings and thoughts, and that's what you've done and you are doing, and it's powerful stuff.
We'll be right back.
I just wanted to pop into your luggles and tell you about my brand spanking new podcast, The Feeding Couch. This podcast ain't just designed with pregnant women or new parents in mind, but also for all of us working in the space of birth work. This is the podcast where I hand the mic over to a different mom, dad, parent, or even grandparent to take us on their feeding journey. Every story matters. It's often through hearing others' experiences where we find our own inner knowledge, strength, and courage. Listen in to hear the stories told of triumph, challenge, heartwarming, tear-jerking, fist-pumping, and how we each deal with our venture into this new world emotionally, socially, and physically. Whether you're a student, a newbie midwife, doula, lactation exam prepper, or just hungry for more knowledge, these stories will also give you a backstage pass to the global lactation clinic. Whether you're pregnant and seeking information or supporting those on their journey, I can't wait to see you on the couch with me soon. Oh, and a little favour, your reviews on Apple Podcasts mean the world. They're like magic beans that help spread the podcast out for those who need to hear it. Let's make this something amazing together.
I mean, there's so much just in what you've said there. I mean, the battles I've had to get research funding. I mean, I'm really, really lucky in that my university is so supportive of all of this. They think it's great. But getting funding can be so, so difficult. And the comments I've had from reviewers of grants, you just think, they wouldn't happen for any other area of health.
Wow.
I've actually had a reviewer say, and this feedback gets given to me, I formula fed my baby and they're fine. I don't know why you carry on trying to research this. I'm just like, gosh. I researched it because you just wrote this comment.
Yeah.
You just showed me why. I've also had feedback saying I'm too evangelical about breastfeeding and that I need to move on to something else. Really? What? The comments just show why it's an issue that needs to carry on. I can't imagine it any other public health area, and I don't want to compare breastfeeding to things like smoking or something, but you wouldn't get the same comments back. You wouldn't say, look, why are you trying to help people to stop smoking? I'm fine and I smoke. Why are you bothering? So yeah. It's the kind of, we treat feeding as some kind of strange hobby of women. It's something strange that they do and doesn't matter. And your point about telling them it doesn't matter. I was just thinking about this again this morning. You know, we torture women with it. We give them all these messages that breastfeeding is best for their baby and that they really should breastfeed. And then they struggle and the support isn't there. And then we tell them that the solution is a bottle.
Yeah.
It's like, and then we tell them that what they wanted to do and we told them that they should do actually doesn't matter. It's just messing with their heads, really. And do we really shocked that they end up then in such a position where they're distressed and showing that in so many different ways.
Yep. God, absolutely. And I think there is so much misunderstanding. And, you know, your book for me, Grief and Trauma, Why Breastfeeding Grief and Trauma Matter. I have to look at the title because I'm really good at remembering titles and things. I remember reading the first couple of pages, and I mean, I break out in tears fairly easily, but it really, because I'd seen it too many times, and just to read someone else who was saying what felt like my words as a clinician, I just cried, because I just felt, I can't believe we're at this point and we're still not seeing how vital and important this is. I mean, when we look at birth trauma, we're still struggling to bring this to light, but with breastfeeding trauma, or the loss of being able to have a choice in how you feed your babies, is replied with those types of comments. Why don't you move on from this? I think you've got the problem because you keep bringing this up type of feedback, and women having that and struggling. And yet actually the system, the whole system's failing us as women who want to try and feed our babies because of medicalization of birth and bringing all these things in. And yet, and then we have women sitting on their own, frightened to go to a group in case she's the only one who's not breastfeeding. It's a minefield for sociology and for someone like you to research, like, it just never ending.
It's also this, the way we treat women's bodies in general, I think. Mm. The whole birth and breastfeeding is such a big part of a woman's life experience if she has a baby. And it's integral to how she feels about herself during that time, but also longer term. And to tell her that it doesn't matter, and that what you're telling her when it doesn't matter that her body isn't working as she thought it was, she can't feed her baby in the way she wants to, that doesn't matter. Any kind of religious or cultural or family traditions that she has don't matter. You're telling her that so much about her and her lifestyle and her traditions and background just don't matter. And dismissing her and suggesting that she has the problem and she's overreacting and it doesn't matter, there's another solution, stop worrying about it. And I know it's not quite the same as erectile dysfunction, but if you go to the research literature and you type in men's experiences of erectile dysfunction, there is so much research that looks at how they feel, how it can affect feelings of masculinity, whatever that may be, how it can affect relationships, how it can affect everything about them. And there are all these kind of programs and support and recognition that it's a big thing because part of their body isn't working. Yeah. They're not told, you know, to go and use something else, or, you know, to their partner will be perfectly happy in a different way. They're taken seriously. And it's just so stark compared to that we just keep telling women it doesn't matter when it does. And the other version of it is when a woman says, look, I'm really, really upset that upset is the wrong word, isn't it? I'm grieving, I'm traumatized by not being able to breastfeed. And it's taken as a criticism of women who had made the decision to formula feed.
Yes.
It's like, I'm personally upset that I can't breastfeed. Why are you making me feel guilty? Why are you saying that I'm a bad mother? Why are you saying that formula is bad? It's like such a leap, because they're not two kind of opposite views. You can be very, very grateful that formula exists and it's there to nourish a baby if you can't breastfeed. Yes. And also simultaneously be grieving not being able to breastfeed. It's not two sides of the coin. You can hold all these different emotions and thoughts at the same time, and then not a criticism as our people. I mean, talking about running earlier, you know, when I used to run lots when I was younger, and then I became overworked, and then, you know, young children, and then quite unwell with thyroid issues. And I really couldn't keep it in check and run at the same time. So I couldn't for years. Mm. And I remember seeing runners going past, and, you know, them running down the street is not criticizing me for not running. You know, me going on that, oh, I really want to go for a run today, is not criticizing anybody who doesn't want to go for a run. it's, you know, it's the same sort of analogy. Yes. I'm not saying, oh, you know, I really want to get out today. Oh, you're terrible for not going for a run. You know, it's no, yeah. not the same thing, is it? It's, yeah.
And yet when we say to women, or they hear that kind of response, what do? We naturally then think, I'm upsetting my friends or upsetting the women that I'm surrounded by, who I'm making them feel guilty or upset because I'm grieving. So then we push our grief down, and then we never get to express it. And this is why, probably as a lactation consultant, I'll maybe be helping a new mom, and her mother, the grandma, then relates her story to me, and she is still deeply, deeply sad and hurting. And that suddenly comes out because she's had been given space to talk about it. And that's when I go, gosh, this is 30 years of hurt that she's had to bury. And you can see why that happens. Those analogies are just, I mean, I've got goosebumps. It's just so, yeah.
And then you've got the intergenerational trauma effect of that, and whether she can put that aside to help her daughter, and how she then feels if her daughter's experience goes well. One of the things in the book that I was shocked at, I thought, because looking at some of the birth trauma literature, and I don't know it all, but sometimes if a woman has a really traumatic first birth and she goes on to have a lovely second birth, then that can be healing for her, that it can help her sort of process some of the difficult birth experience that her body has now done what she wanted it to do, all of that. With the breastfeeding, what a number of women said to me is that they had a really awful first experience and had to stop really soon. And then the second time round, they managed to get the support that they needed. And, you know, the baby was different, everything was different, and it went really, really well. And it was then that all the trauma hit them, because suddenly they realized that actually, A, they weren't broken, their body was working, they could do this. And they realized just how much they'd been let down the first time. So it just suddenly hit them of how awful it was. And that second breastfeeding experience, although on one level was amazing, was the part that brought out all that trauma, because they realized that it could be different. And that shocked me. I thought that second good breastfeeding experience would help heal it. But of course, it's slightly different, and kind of, we don't realize a lot of the time just how many external factors are influencing our ability to breastfeed or not. Sort of, you know, almost a roll of the dice sometimes in terms of, okay, so you can be prepared, you can be educated. I've had friends who, due to things going wrong, have breastfed other babies for years and then really struggled on another baby and had to stop. You know, it's always just such a lottery of if you're in the right place at the right time and where you can get that support.
Yeah.
And I think helping more women and just everyone in general to realize how much a woman's experience is affected by all those different factors around her is vital, because I've sort of seen a change. It's been quite gradual, but if you look back between now and say 2 years ago, we don't seem to be arguing about breastfeeding as much. We seem to have more recognition that there are lots of different factors that can affect a woman's experience, and it's not her who's failed. There seems to be a bit less internalization of it. I'm seeing far more women speak out openly about how awful they felt when they weren't able to breastfeed. And rather than saying, it doesn't matter, you're making me feel guilty, more women are kind of recognizing that they've been so badly let down, and they're talking about it. I don't know if it's just me, but nobody is yelling at me on the internet anymore. It's quite boring. You know, I'm going to go have a fight with somebody.
No journalist who's writing an article and finds your name.
Yeah. It's kind of like I can talk about breastfeeding on the internet now, and sometimes nobody says anything negative at all. And I'm like, oh, that's odd. So either things have got better or I've become insignificant. It's one of the two.
No, that's really interesting.
It is really noticing a difference.
Wow. And do you think that's just the UK? Or, I mean, obviously the internet's global, but
yeah,
people know where you're...
I don't know. I mean, it just seems calmer. Just seems that fewer people are really expressing real anger or really taking what you say as a criticism. I mean, they're all going to pop up today now, aren't they? I've just had to say. But,
and then when we release this as well.
Feel like I'm alive again. I think we're getting there. We're starting to realise, just like it took years, decades to realise that birth trauma was a thing. I think we're getting there with breastfeeding and realising the emotional impact and realising that if I say I'm hurting because I can't breastfeed, it's not a criticism of someone else's decision.
I think that is such a strong, important point. Like, I just want to leave it and that'd be the quote for this. Just, that's it, really. It's just giving ourselves permission.
That's the nugget. Is that the nugget?
How have I not even said that is the golden nugget? Absolutely. It is not a nugget of poo, Amy. It is a golden nugget, always. Bloody marvellous. Yeah. I mean, I'm just processing what you've talked about, and that just feels like maybe there's a shift happening and we're at this point where women, okay, we've stopped the kind of inverted commas mommy wars of, you know, black or white, you formula, just be thankful that your baby can feed, to, you know, you just talk about breastfeeding or it didn't go right, can you now shut up and just be grateful that you've got formula type of scenarios. And for women to be allowed to speak their truth, to say I'm hurting right now and I need to grieve this, is a processing. And then also, once we start to process, we can start looking outwards and to say, do you know what? This happened and this happened and I wasn't supported here. COVID happened, or there were no drop-ins, or my so-and-so was telling me to use formula, or I had a really traumatic birth. I didn't realize that losing a lot of blood was going to impact my supply. You know, able to actually, instead of just being in this bubble of maybe grief, which is all-consuming, particularly if we're then going from a traumatic birth to a poor breastfeeding experience and potentially post-traumatic stress, it's very difficult to see outside of this sort of small world that you're within. And when we can, maybe we can start to see this external influence, this is what led to this point. I'm not at fault. And it doesn't mean I'm broken, like you say, your words. That's really potentially and hopefully powerful, because then what we can use is those women who then can heal become the women who start standing up, fighting for better care for their next birth, their next baby, but also then starting to be noisy and saying more research should be done. I'm going to write to my MP. I'm going to write to the health authority. And for me, that seems to be like, ooh, grassroots change.
Yeah. And that's what we desperately, desperately need, that we need those women who are grieving or traumatized to recognize what happened to them and be part of the solution for the next generation, because we're not going to move forward without it. Because I think sometimes one of the biggest barriers to pushing forward any change is, unfortunately, people who have been so hurt by their treatment and experience, and they're internalizing all of that they then deliberately or sort of subconsciously block the effort to try and move things forward. Mm. So they're so stuck because they're so unsupported, they've been so let down, they're so traumatized by their whole experience that anybody talking about it is just too much for them. So they try to stop that conversation, or they see that conversation as attacking them when it never is. Or perhaps some people use it, but, you know, they're terrible people, well, let's ignore them. What we're trying to do is make things so that the next generation of women don't have to experience this. We know, looking at other countries, that it can be different. We know that breastfeeding can work. So we need to move to a place where we've created that environment and culture that supports it. But sometimes all the kind of arguments around fed is best, or, you know, this idea of one way or another, or two groups of women, it stops us moving things forward into a place where absolutely everybody is supported with their decisions. We don't want to move it forward to a place where everybody is forced to or has to breastfeed in some sort of, you know, strange kind of situation.
Handmaid's tale kind of thing.
Yeah, of course not. We want everyone to be in a position where they've got the information to make the decision that's right for their family, and then the support to carry it through. That's all we want.
Simple, isn't it, really? Yeah. We're actually trying to be quite nice and just say, we've got some information, here you go.
And once we reach that place, it'll be so, so different. And people who are in power and who don't want to see change because it'll mean investment or cost or upsetting their friends and donors from the formula industry, I'm sure there's all sorts of stuff going on there, encourage that. Women fighting with each other, and the concept of the mummy wars just is made up. It's not actually true, because, well, in the UK at least, virtually all, let's say 90, I think it's around 90-95% of women at some point, if they've been breastfeeding, use formula. So the vast majority of women are doing both. So how can there be two camps? The idea of, you know, we've got less than, well, around 1% of women who exclusively breastfeed to 6 months. How can they be some evil majority camp that is yelling at everybody else and making them feel guilty? It's, you know, either they're extremely powerful women or something's being sold to us because the people in charge don't want to make the changes that are necessary and don't want to make the investment is necessary and don't want to recognize that this is so important to women. And that's what we should be questioning. I always bring it back to, would men be treated this way? Would powerful white men be treated this way? No. So let's keep fighting for to make things better.
Absolutely. I'm just waiting in case Rachel's pensive or
no, she's glaring at me.
Good job I warned you, huh? Because it's just the flinty glares and you're like, oh my god, I'm in an interview.
Maybe she really, really likes powerful white men. Who knows? She really wants, you know.
Wow, that is gonna push Rachel's buttons. She's gonna explode right now. You know how to press Rachel's buttons. Thank God for internet delays, huh? Look, oh, that's the head tilt. That's the one I get. That's the, I'm not impressed.
I haven't done the hand yet.
When she tells me to shut up. She just, with the glary, glinty glasses. That's when I go, oh my God, I'm in so much trouble. Oh, God. Oh, jeepers. I think, Rachel, I just wanted to link into your... are you doing the hand at me? Oh, okay. No. I just saw this, but it was delayed on the thing, so I wasn't sure whether I was getting the hand to stop talking, because I do want you to talk. But what I found really interesting in your Informed is Best book was, one, I was actually really surprised that you had written this type of book for mums, and I was thrilled. The stuff I refreshed, but also huge amounts I learned as well, is awesome. But that really brings me back what you just said about kind of like the mummy wars are made up. We should think about how, you know, rich white men in power are treated, but that also about the stance in terms of where the story's coming from. So which news report or newspaper we have read, what their, you know, their tendencies are. And we might have a female journalist, but we have seen some, you know, some of the articles that have been written over the years about their personal experiences with breastfeeding. And you can almost palpate the absolute fear and hurt that is deep, and it's coming out as this sort of vitriolic anger. But also I think just looking at where the story has come from was it's like something I knew, but how you explained it in the book was just, ooh, I loved it.
So thinking about sort of who owns the news and sort of their tendencies. So a lot of right-wing newspapers, and of course, you know, it's a pattern rather than everybody who has right-wing tendencies being high in something called right-wing authoritarianism, which I can't say, it's too big a word.
Thankfully for spell check on when you write it.
So, that word. But people who have RWA, let's call it, tend to be, you know, they tend to be very sexist. They tend to be against women in power, making powerful decisions. They tend to be very traditional and thinking women should be at home and not heard or seen, or is that children? Hang on, one of the two. They probably think the same of women too.
Yeah, think the same, probably.
And how that then affects view. So they've done some studies around, you know, concepts of not wanting women to be in charge of medical decisions and things like this. So if someone is very, you know, high in right-wing authoritarianism, there we go, they hate the idea of a woman exercising a right to a home birth or breastfeeding in public or something like that. And then all of this gets picked up by that right-wing framed media and is used to subtly try and, or not so subtly, kind of control women and their decisions. And you're right, whenever I see an article written by a powerful female journalist about, you know, the pressure to breastfeed or something, I just think, well, what's the background to all of this story? Why are you so angry, or why are you so passionate about stopping women being supported to breastfeed? Because that's essentially what you're often saying with that type of article. And where is it all coming from, if not a place of grief and trauma and hurt? Because if breastfeeding wasn't important to you and you didn't care about it and it's not important, as you're saying, why are you writing such an angry article? It just doesn't make it, you know, it doesn't make any sense. I know, and I know other people can put pressure on us and other people can try and make us feel guilty, but it's in the vast majority of cases because we're holding quite strong personal views ourselves. So the pressure is usually from within a lot of the time, that you can only be made to feel pressurized or be made to feel guilty if something was important to you in the first place, particularly if you're a very strong person and you can't be made to feel guilty about something. That doesn't matter. No one is ever going to make me feel guilty about how much gin I've got in the house. You know, they can do whatever. I really don't care. You're never going to make me feel like I drink too much gin ever. Try all you like. It's not going to happen.
I'm with you, Amy. It's great.
But you could make me feel guilty maybe about other things that, you know, I kind of feel, you know, worried about to do with the children or something, or decisions I've made over the years, because those things were important to me and I've got these sort of thoughts in my head already. And that's not the same as ever saying it's all right to pressurize or make a woman feel guilty. Nobody should ever be doing that. But I think a lot of the "you're making me feel bad" is because it's more of a "you're reminding me that I feel bad," rather than "you're directly creating this thought in me that I've never had before." It's so complicated, and it just has to come from a place of kindness and support and unpicking what happened to her, whoever the, you know, I can think of several over the years who have written quite vitriolic pieces. You know, it was, where was she not supported? Where was she treated terribly? Where did somebody tell her, you know, what she was doing was wrong or whatever? You know, all of that comes back to that point we talked about earlier about we want women to have information and we want them to have support to follow through their choices. And that's all that we're fighting for. It's not making all women breastfeed or something.
Exactly.
I love that book. And I particularly love the social media tricks and the "who is the messenger" chapters.
Yeah.
I had no idea what a sea lion was. That was a new one for me.
No, me neither.
I'd love you to talk a little, because I have a real dysfunctional relationship with social media, I think, as I really don't like it, but now I have to do it. So I have this weird relationship with it, and I would love to hear your take on how do women and care providers navigate the social media platforms to get the information and know whether it's good or to assess it? Like, give us some tips.
I have to go back to the sea lion point, first of all, because I don't go, like, on my Twitter bio, it says dislike sea lions. And I don't get past a week without someone going, what have you got against sea lions? They're lovely. And I'm like, I really don't mean the animal. I mean the behaviour on the internet. So if people don't know what sea lioning is, it's basically somebody who keeps coming back at you and repeatedly asking you for more and more information. Say, for example, I could tweet, breastfeeding is important to women. We must support it. And they'd come back and say, oh, but can you give me evidence that breastfeeding is important to women? And you're like, what? Oh, okay, right. Maybe you go down and you go, well, have a read of this paper. You're like, but I don't think that paper really showed it, did it? Can you show me more information? And can you show me more? And what about this? And what about that? And it's usually polite, but it is repetitive and it's demanding evidence for something that's doesn't need loads of evidence over and over and over again, because it's a time waster and they're trying to trip you up and trying to make it look like you don't have enough evidence for what you're saying. And it is so infuriating, because they'll come back and say, but I'm being perfectly nice. I'm being perfectly reasonable. Why won't you, you know, respond to me for the 500th time on this? Mm-hmm. And so that's sea lions. Oh, well, in terms of navigating the internet, I mean, it's with a hard hat on, I think, some of the time. It's about being sure of your message and delivering your message in the way that you want to, without getting too bogged down by the politics and the arguing. I just don't get into discussions anymore with people who try to derail things. I just keep popping back up and putting out the messages that I want to and ignoring the fighting or the comments, because you'll never ever win in an internet fight. Sometimes I'll really simply respond to a criticism once. If they say you're making women feel guilty, say no, that's not the intention. It's about women feeling informed and supported, and then not go back, because they'll keep trying over and over and you'll just always end up in some sort of internet hell where you can't get back out again and it'll ruin your week. Mm-hmm. It's about, it's about the stuff around checking sources, being responsible for what you're putting out, realizing that you can't change everybody on the internet. You can try, pointing out incorrect or infactual information in a nice way, but we kind of now focus on trying to put as many positive messages out there as possible rather than worrying about what other people are saying. Because if you spend all your time worrying about what other people are saying, you'll never have time to put your own positive message back out there.
Mm.
Yeah. That's a 3-hour conversation in itself, really. How do you navigate the internet carefully, kindly.
Buy Amy's book. It's bloody marvelous.
Yeah, buy my book.
It's all right. You can do plugs here. We do plugs for Rachel's. Buy Rachel's book as well. Another plug. Get it in there. I haven't written one. One will come eventually. One day. I'll just do a quick edit of something for 50,000 words.
Your grammar out first.
Let's not talk about my grammar or my spelling. Apologies to anyone who listens or even looks at our Instagram. Just like, what is the newspaper? The Guardian. They pride themselves on the fact that you can spot a mistake. I'm like that. I do it for fun. So
somebody did write to me and they were very angry with me for having some spelling mistakes the other day.
Oh, I feel so validated now. Thank you.
I did a very quick post and they were angry and told me I needed to get someone to proofread everything before I put it on the internet.
Well, I'm not offering to be your proofread. Oh my God, I can't believe that. They took the time to actually say that. And
the response I wanted to write back but didn't was that I think they should get somebody to check all their messages before they sent them. Delayed laugh. There we go.
It's great, isn't it, with the delay? It's just, it really captures the essence of at least she's smiling in her froze position now. This is why we burst into song and comedy, because it's just like, this is how we cope. Oh, my God. God, I can't believe someone actually took the time to to write about that.
Yeah, it was a very teachery voice. I felt, you know, I was about 8 years old and had been told off.
Did you go back and change the post and edit your spelling? Great. Yes. Good on you. Fantastic. Brill. Rachel, are you back with us now?
No.
No. She did give us the fingers. Okay. Give me that. It wasn't at you, Amy. That was clearly at me, just in case. I'm just hearing like little laughs from Rachel, and then I'm like, is she going to start speaking or not? God, this is so bloody awful. We seriously need a studio and actually internet connection. Rachel lives like in the forest in the back end of a beautiful place, but literally she's got a massive antenna that is just, you know, 20 foot high, and it's still this great. This is how good the internet is. I don't know why I decided to start a podcast between Switzerland and Australia, but everything would have to be done online. Clearly didn't think about internet issues, because most countries got it sorted out, really.
It's because it's satellite. It's because it's satellite, so it's got to go all the way up into the sky to bounce off a thing to come back down again. So that's what the delay is.
Bloody hell.
I'm being transmitted up through the sky.
And then I have to edit that sky and try and like cut it so it makes one word, or I do a bang and make a stop and then start again. Oh, God, Amy. Brilliant.
Sky. There you go. There's the word you can put it in.
Yeah, because my editing skills are really that good.
Well, you managed to make me say fear instead of sphere, so they're pretty good.
You can shut up, because that never happened, because I haven't got those skill sets, and you said fear or sphere or whatever it was wrong, and you said it. So there, enough on that one. We're in a new year. You can't go backwards. I wanted to...
I'm just still stuck in the internet. Like, no, you go on. You wanted to. You sound, no, you look like you've got something to say. Don't waggle your finger at me.
Just ask Amy's on the ask side of it. No, I've got mine written down. Yours will be coming up in your head. Go.
No, it's not coming up quickly. You do yours.
For sake. Oh, God. I need a gin. I think it's almost gin o'clock. It's up past 10, so you know. It's a bit of a backtrack. In your books, you talk about this primitive response, this natural instinct, and we talk so much about physiological birth. And I think with breastfeeding, we don't always bring it down to that real instinctual drive for a mother to feel this need to do it for her body to be functioning, and then how that leads on.
I think it goes back to that concept of what, from a physiological, biological point of view, the body is expecting after birth. So not to get confused with some sort of social imperative that you must breastfeed your baby or any decisions around that, but taking us purely back to biological mammals. Mammals are designed to breastfeed their baby. Many people would say it is the fourth stage of labour as such, that, you know, the placenta is delivered, the baby latches on and feeds. And historically, a woman's hormone patterns and physiology would be designed to breastfeed that baby and then breastfeed that baby for a couple of years or so at least. So from that perspective, from a subconscious perspective, from some sort of mammalian animal perspective, is the body expecting to breastfeed after birth? So what then happens if breastfeeding doesn't happen or breastfeeding stops prematurely? We can rationalize and understand what has happened, but subconsciously, what are we feeling? Do we think that something has happened to that baby because that baby isn't being breastfed? Is there some sort of physiological need as such to be breastfeeding that plays back into our subconscious and then kind of impacts on those feelings of grief and loss, even though now, as more developed mammals, we can understand what has happened and we know the baby is still there and the baby is thriving on formula and that's fine. What does our sort of mammalian brain say to us? And it also, I think, goes through to then of a kind of primal need to nourish and feed our babies in a particular way. So we know that breastfeeding isn't just about getting milk into the baby. It was never designed just to be that. Those first feeds of colostrum we know are so full of antibodies and other brilliant stuff that we know it's essentially medicine, not just food. There's such small amounts of it. It's not about getting huge amounts of milk into a baby. It's about immune transfer. And then as that baby gets older, and as you see in many cultures around the world who have their babies in slings and the baby has free access to the breast and is on and off all day, it's completely normal for it to be a mothering tool as such. So it's there to soothe the baby, to get the baby to sleep when the baby wakes up, to calm them if they've fallen over, if they're unwell. It's part of caring for a baby in that way. And I think that's very, very instinctual if we're able to listen to our bodies and those who are supportive of breastfeeding around us, because of course society's telling us that, you know, the baby's manipulating us and we're making a rod for their back and they're feeding too much and all of that. So we have this sort of need to nourish and nurture our babies in that way. And when that gets taken away from us, we're grieving that. It's a loss. It's our normal. And I hate using the word normal because it always gets interpreted as, you know, we should be doing this or you're abnormal if you don't. But I mean it from a mammalian physiological perspective that it's just what we were designed to do after having a baby and have done for many, many thousands of years. So it's how it all ties in with that. And then when you lose the function of your body being able to act in that way, the grief of that, that often it's not necessarily about the milk. I mean, you know, if you ask any pregnant or new mother, why do you want to breastfeed? She'll automatically say, oh, because it'll help protect my baby against illness. And yes, of course, that's important, but there's so much more to it. It's not just about the milk. It's about the nurture and the connection. And again, that's not to say that you can't connect or nurture with a bottle-fed baby, but it's just a different way of doing it. And it's a specific way that we lose. And losing that connection and ability to get them back to sleep at night makes everything feel so much more challenging as well. So it's about how that sort of all kind of fits together, and all that loss kind of compounds itself. And we wonder why women are grieving and traumatized by not being able to do any of this. You know, even whenever I say that, I'm always worrying, you know, still worrying that someone will come back and say, you're judging me for not nurturing and caring for my baby in that way. And it's not to say that your baby isn't nurtured and cared for. It's you're nurturing and caring for them in a different way. But it's just recognizing that when women want to be able to feed their baby in that way, what they lose over and above the milk.
Absolutely. And I think as a researcher, you know, if we don't have research like yours that's looking into this and looking into how women feel, how do we ever make change? Because we've talked about it being at the grassroots, but we know that it needs to go on a much further level. And if we don't have the stories of women, how do we get this to be heard? Because, you know, there is a lot of noise out there. And really what you're stating is the physiological process of us as women and what we go through in the birth process and then into breastfeeding. And that needs to be heard. And if we keep shutting down researchers like you and people who speak about it because there's hurt and pain, and if people like you succumb and don't stand up online, in forums, with books, and talk about what women's real experiences are, we're actually not listening to women. We're not allowing ourselves to be heard, to be seen. And your role is so important.
And I think a lot of the time I end up doing research that is almost obvious in some ways. And, you know, I've had colleagues look at me like, you're mad. So one of the best ones was the research we did that showed that babies wake up at night. That was really good research, top class. But it was actually really useful because what it showed was that breast and formula fed babies didn't wake up any differently.
Yeah.
But, you know, it became the, what have you just researched?
Why would you do that? But actually,
But A, from a scientific perspective, that it's important to have, until something is published in data, you haven't got it to be able to reference and build on.
Yeah.
But B, we desperately need to do it because of all those sea lions on Twitter. People go, well, show me the evidence for that.
Yes.
And you're like,
oh my God. Just speak to anyone.
I've put it in the grief and trauma book, but the whole grief and trauma book came about because of some white man on the internet. So I'd made a comment that it was, someone was talking about breastfeeding experiences, and I said, oh, it's almost as if these women are traumatized. And he popped up out of nowhere and went, you can't use the word trauma when it comes to breastfeeding. I don't know about you, but being told I can't do something, particularly by some middle-aged man on the internet, was like, right. So I went off and did this research. I mean, it put together a study. I had over 2,000 women respond in the, you know, it was a couple of weeks or so, just the outpouring of grief. And I thought, well, there we go. Here's your book. Yes, you can. But it's that whole process of establishing evidence to fight back against this. And I just sometimes think, can't we just accept that this stuff matters to women? You know, it's, and again, this is, talk about this informed is best, the whole exhaustion of having to prove and provide evidence these days for stuff that is normal. So whenever anybody goes, right, you have to show me the evidence that breastfeeding protects babies, I'm like, oh, it's what they were designed to do.
That's my reaction as well, like, oh, God.
The onus should be on alternative milks to prove that they support babies' development. It should never have to be on breastfeeding to prove that it is beneficial to babies. It's our milk of our species. Of course, it's going to be designed for us. So having to, you know, having to prove things like having a good birth is important to women, you know, it's like, well, why on earth do you have to prove that? You know, So it's an exhausting area of research to do, but so worthwhile one at the same time, because it actually means something when you publish it, because you can actually help people with it and be part of that effort to move this forward. But yeah, the research about the obvious is what I spend a lot of time doing just to get that evidence base, because nobody has, not bothered, that's the wrong word, nobody has really been in the place to be able to research a lot of this before, because again, you know, to be in my position, you know, I had to get an academic job in the first place. I had to do enough research and get enough research funding to become a professor, which then gives you a lot of power in publishing more, in bringing in research funding, in being listened to. But the whole barriers that are placed in people's way to get there, especially when they research this kind of area, it's so, so challenging. People are always saying to me, well, how can I get to your position? And I'm like, right, buckle up.
I can imagine.
And, you know, the stats from Informed is Best, that I think it's 68% of professors in the UK are white men, less than 1% black women. You know, it's shocking. And researchers research what matters to them.
Yeah.
We'd like to say, you know, we're completely neutral and we do anything, but we get drawn to an area because it's of interest. Say your typical middle-aged white man is not going to be investigating women's experiences of birth and breastfeeding. The men in this area tend to be doing the big randomized controlled trials. So they do stuff about induction or cesarean sections. They tend to do the intervention stuff in the big numbers. They're not doing the women's experiences stuff.
Yeah.
So it's,
and this is why I'm not going to be a professor. You know, that will not happen. The career advice I have been given on more than one occasion is literally get over yourself. You need to get on into these big randomized control trials, and you need to be studying, you know, it doesn't matter if you're interested in it. That's what you need to be doing. And, you know, I'm absolutely sticking with researching women's experiences of things, because that's not there. And like you were saying, you know, how can you cite research to support an argument or to support change if it's not there, you know, and once it's published. And that's, you know, it's sad that that has to happen, that the bleeding obvious has to get published in order for you to then use it to argue a point to make change. But, you know, that's where we're at.
I was given exactly the same advice probably about 8 years ago now, that I was told that I had to move away from, not by anybody at my institution, I was told I had to move away from breastfeeding and look wider, maybe at nutrition if I was interested in that, and do the big randomized controlled trials. And somehow, I mean, there's luck on side. And again, I keep going back to the point that I'm very fortunate that my university can see the impact of what I do. They can see that it's important and they can see that it matters, and they can see that it's well kind of accepted and liked, and they're happy to support their professor who runs around the world talking, you know, on podcasts talking about erectile dysfunction. I recognize that I'm extremely lucky. I mean, there's been a load of hard work involved, is luck to get where I am now as well. And I recognize that very few people can actually get to this place without having to do the other stuff as well. Because I hate randomized controlled trials. I just have a real hatred of them. Just like they cost so much money and never really seem to conclude very much. And you're like, right. If I look at the money that goes into them, I think just how many studies that could be done that actually are more useful on the ground. Well, for this area anyway, randomized controlled trials have their place in, you know, other areas of health research. But when it comes to women's experiences of stuff.
Got absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I just feel so grateful that we have you and a handful, really, it feels like, of other researchers in this field who are really championing this area. And it's just so sad that we don't have more. And the access isn't easy, but I just, you know, the women who have access to your stuff, to your books, to your social media, who are not C-lining you, the healthcare professionals, other researchers following in your footsteps. Like, I want to say thank you, and I'm grateful for you, because it has obviously been an incredibly difficult journey to get there, and it is for anyone in your position. And you do a bloody good job, and it's just bloody wonderful, and we're really just so chuffed to have had you on the podcast, really.
Trying to put everything together. I haven't finished it yet, although it's in a good state, that my website, my new website, where I'm trying to put everything on there. So if anybody wants to go and look for the research, it's professoramybrown.co.uk. I'm in the process of trying to upload every single one of my research articles onto there.
Ooh,
I started
brilliant.
Doing that and I'm like, oh.
I've done a lot. I bet you thought that. It was a good feeling and a dread feeling of like, oh God, copy paste, so, copy upload.
I'm trying to put a version on there that gives you the full article. So it's either because the full article is available online or we're allowed under publishing law or whatever it is to put up preprint versions of stuff. So that's what's taking the time. I'm trying to find out all the laws and regulations for each paper to make sure that there's actually a paper under there, not just click abstract paywall. Oh
yep. Amy, that is brilliant. That's such brilliant news. Really great. I look forward to that. I dread the fact that you have to do all of that. I can only imagine how arduous that little job, bit like the editing. I'll just do a quick edit. Yeah.
Doesn't help that I'm actually incredibly disorganized and don't actually have a full list or folder of all my papers everywhere. They're just all on the cloud somewhere. And I'm like, oh. I need someone to come and organize. I don't know how I can have written so much and been so disorganized at the same time. It's quite impressive, really.
It sounds like you've got a very busy life, but it does sound like you need someone to proofread all of your tweets for spelling and also priority. Come and organize your own personal research so that
please.
You can find how much you've written. Awesome. Amy, is there any final thoughts? Is there burning desires that you would like to get out to the audience that will be listening of where we can make change, how we can stand up for what is right or what needs to be happening in this area or within the greater sort of maternal health side?
I think it's just recognizing what breastfeeding means to women who want to breastfeed and supporting their voice in that. So recognizing why it's important. It's not just about health. It's not just about babies. They matter as well. Their own health matters, their own beliefs and traditions, and just desire for their body to work matters. And we must elevate those voices and we must push that forward, because that's the only way we're ever going to see change. And I think at one point I said to somebody, you know, if you're fed up of listening to me banging on about breastfeeding because you don't want to hear it and it's making you feel bad, the very best thing you can do is do everything you can to support breastfeeding in the short term so we can make it better, and then I can shut up. I'll go away then. If we can actually make it better, can we just speed this up, please? Then we can all stop going on about it because it'll be fine and we won't need to. So be part of the solution.
Love it. That's brilliant. Thank you so much for joining us in the cauldron today. It has been absolutely wonderful. You are just so insightful and full of knowledge. I highly recommend that anybody just pick up any of Amy's books, head to her website. You will be, if you haven't already, you're in for a treat. And also, I must say, the way Amy writes is feels like you're having a cup of tea with her in her room. It's just really easy reads. And then she sort of punches you in the face, not literally, but figuratively, with these awesome facts that make you go, oh my God, that's incredible. So it's been a delight and a joy. And I'm just so grateful. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
It has indeed. Thank you so much, Amy. I'm going to rush over to your Instagram and I'm going to start C-lining you.
Thanks for being with us here in the cauldron. We hope you enjoyed listening and learning from Amy just as much as we did. Please head over to our links to find Amy's website. And of course, if you're not already, then definitely follow her on Instagram. But hey, no C-lining, okay? Your support to this podcast matters, and as we grow, we hear so many of your personal stories. It is beyond amazing, and we are really grateful. We love seeing this tribe of amazing people coming together to fight for what matters. We want more like-minded women and people who work in the birthing world to be able to hear this information. And what really helps is your story sharing, whether by word of mouth to your colleagues and friends or via your own social media. So go on, keep telling them to listen in. But we also need the big guys to see us and to get us into their algorithms. Not so much the ear holes, unfortunately. Apple Podcasts in particular. Every extra review we get helps our podcast come up as an offering for someone just like you to see. And maybe, just maybe, they listen to. So I know I say it every episode, but if you haven't yet, please pop over to Apple and give us a review, preferably a 5-star one, of course. Thank you. Thank you so much, you wonderful people, for listening and being with us in the cauldron. And as always, here's the bloopers. Until next time.
Don't know the song.
It's from Rocky Horror. There's a light.
That was a sneaky record.
Well, it's like Amy's going to come in and I'll forget. It wasn't a sneaky record.
There's more than one light.
Can you shine the light on your face? Or like, how do you guys even cope?
Not really. There's a light up there that's on my face. And there's a light because it's bloody night for some of us in the world. Hang on. How about that? I can't because the light... I have to get a lamp or something in my face.
You do need a lamp in your face. Good morning, Amy. We don't put video on, so you're safe. And Rachel's always in a bra anyway, normally. It's only because it's winter that she's not now.
Some weird people on the internet would want to pay a fortune for...
Wouldn't they just? All these naked professors.
Yeah.
I mean, that would definitely be how I'd advertise that on Instagram. Get your fill. Two naked professors.
Oh, I'm not a professor. I'm just a doctor.
Oh, sorry. Oh, gosh. One, I've elevated Rachel. Wondering which of my courses is for you? Breastfeeding and Lactation, The Fundamentals has been designed for everyone working in the birthing field or those on their journey to becoming breastfeeding specialists or IBCLCs. This course gives you 7 hours of CPD and is packed with reflective learning, case studies and some pretty tough at times quizzes to make sure this stuff sticks. It also means you can meet me monthly in my live Q&A. This is my course that I hope will fill in the gaps that traditional breastfeeding education has left out. I want you completing this, feeling confident to support any breastfeeding or lactation challenge of those in your care. But wait, I have another course called The Feeding Couch. Who's this for? Currently, around 80 to 96% of women decide to breastfeed during their pregnancy, but by just 8 weeks after birth, a third to almost 50% of those women have stopped breastfeeding. And of those women who stopped, 80% say they stopped breastfeeding before they wanted to. Learning about breastfeeding during pregnancy has been shown to improve breastfeeding self-confidence and improve the rate of exclusive breastfeeding in the short and the long term. I believe every mum should be able to choose how she wants to feed her baby and for how long. Knowledge is power. That's why I created The Feeding Couch, designed to be watched during pregnancy or for new mums and parents who may be struggling right now with breastfeeding. The content is in step-by-step, binge-worthy whilst pregnant or for those most tired of days postpartum. Totally easy to find exactly what you need and dip in and out when you need a breastfeeding answer quickly. And for you, beautiful podcast listener, there is a 10% discount off both courses when you use the code POD10, that's P-O-D-10, at checkout. To find out more, hop on over to my website, katiejames.site, and have a look at the incredible content waiting for your lucky peepers.